This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is Friday, time for the Week in Review. Thousands of Market Basket employees keep up their strike and support of the company's ousted CEO as a new bid for the chain comes from the giant parent company of Hannaford's. Plus, the Massachusetts Parole Board votes to release Joseph Donovan. Convicted at the age of 17 in the murder of an MIT student, Donovan spent more than two decades in prison. Here's his aunt, Patricia Donovan.
I always thought Joey got a raw deal. You know, he's a good kid, and he always was a good kid. You know, I know he's going to make the best of this.
Also, if voters aren't enthralled by the relatively sleepy gubernatorial race so far, one candidate says that's why the state needs a third party.
There's broad-based bipartisan agreement on all sorts of issues that are very, very important to ordinary voters, small business people, but they don't act on that basis.
And in the State House now, an $11 million makeover to the current governor's office.
Some of the color choices that the Historic Commission insisted on are not ones I would necessarily have made.
But at $2 million over budget, some taxpayers are not laughing. Well, joining me now to talk more about these stories and the rest of the week in the news is former federal judge and now Harvard Law School professor Nancy Gertner. Nancy, always great to see you.
Nice to be here.
Also with us today, Boston Globe columnist Joan Vinaki. Joan, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So let's first start off with this ongoing, fascinating story at Market Basket. Reports now that the Belgium-based parent company of Hannaford Brothers has emerged as a serious bidder for the Market Basket supermarket chain. And this, as we mentioned, of course, thousands of employees still continue their weeks-long protest in support of Arthur T. Demoulas, the ousted CEO. Now, the company is losing a lot of money. Reports for the past week or two, millions of dollars each day, shelves empty, warehouse workers on strike. And now part-time employees get their hours severely cut, possibly even entirely. So, Joan, let me just start with you. Every day it seems to be something new with Market Basket, but what's your take on where things stand now?
Well, I just wanted to throw in that I saw on Twitter that Governor Patrick now is offering to get involved.
Yes, he is.
And that's the first time that he's done that. So,
well, in fact, let me just jump in here because I actually have a small copy of the letter he sent today to Market Basket's board of directors. He says in the letter that he's offering to help. He's not saying he will. If they ask, he'll help. He says, "The disruption caused by your recent change in CEO has gotten out of hand, and I'm writing to urge you to find a prompt resolution. The failure to resolve this matter is not only hurting the company's brand and business, but also hurting many innocent and relatively powerless workers whose livelihoods depend on you."
So the question is, where do I see this ending?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I mean, Arthur T. won the PR war several weeks ago, but whether he actually can win the end game, you know, the corporate war, to come back in as CEO, I have my doubts about that.
Mm. Nancy, your thoughts?
I don't think I've ever seen a situation where Arthur T's sort of ace in the hole are the employees. It's such an unusual situation, and the question is, how far are these employees willing to go for apparently well-loved CEO, which is a very unusual situation. It's one thing to say that this is a battle fueled by people with lots of money, but when you're talking about his major weapon being these employees, that's troubling.
Right.
That's troubling.
Well, it's interesting because part of the story is, of course, the acrimonious relationship between Arthur T. Demoulas and his cousin Arthur S. Demoulas within the family and therefore the ownership of Market Basket, but also the story of why employees are rallying behind Arthur T. Demoulas. I mean, he has a reputation of having given employees solid wages in the past, regular bonuses, a generous profit-sharing plan, and CNN recently put it this way, quote, "Here's something you don't see every day, the 99% demonstrating in support of the 1%. Huh. So, Joan, let me ask you, I mean, isn't that part of the story here that just this kind of job, it's relatively low income, but here's a low income job in a company that was treating its employees well. It's so rare that people are willing to fight for it. They're willing to put those jobs on the line.
Well, it's definitely man bites dog, as we say, or used to say in the journalism business. But, you know, it's a really simple storyline, and usually stories in the end turn out to be more complicated than that. I don't know what's really going on behind the scenes. I tend not to believe the total. Arthur T. has taken on mythic proportions.
Yes.
as Santa Claus, as this amazing CEO. And yes, he does have loyalty. Obviously, people are out there putting their jobs on the line. You don't see that at all. Not to mention, not often. You don't see it at all. But there is something, Nancy said, troubling, and I agree. There's something troubling about using workers as pawns like that in this game, where two rich men in the end are, you know, they don't have all that much at stake except pride and ego.
Mm. Well, I'm not sure that all the workers themselves would see that they are being used as pawns. I mean, we have a tape here from Steve Palenka. He was a former supervisor for Market Basket and was fired in July for helping start this protest movement to restore Arthur T. He had been with Market Basket for 40 years, so let's listen.
This sense of family we have with our employees extends to our customers. I've talked to a lot of media folks and a lot of people in business schools and stuff that are much smarter than me. And quite frankly, a lot of you still just don't get it. Arthur T. DeMolis has told me 1,000 times in the last 10 years, Stevie, we're in the grocery business second, we're in the people business first.
So, Nancy, I mean, that's, you can feel the depth of Steve Palenka's feeling on this. But I understand that when you were sitting on the bench, you heard a lot of cases where there was ownership disputes in businesses. For the ones that end up in court, like, do these surrounding factors make any difference whatsoever?
No. The things that were before me seem antiseptic yet next to this. I mean, the notion that employees would go out on strike for one side or the other, particularly in a family business, is extraordinary. It didn't even happen in family businesses. I don't believe when we say that when you talk about the employees being pawns, I don't think that it doesn't sound, at least, like that was anyone's intent. But they are the people with so much to lose here. For example, if the company is taken over by a third party that is a publicly traded company, their rights will be even less. So it is extraordinary what they're doing on his behalf.
And I would just throw this out as pure speculation. I have nothing to back it up. But who's to say maybe some of these managers who were fired may be compensated by Arthur T. during all this, whereas the great mass of people aren't. So, I mean, we really don't know the full story. I don't want to be a skeptic. I don't want to be a cynic. They don't see themselves as pawns, but they have everything on the line.
Right. And like you said, there's so much that we don't know about the story. But I was interested to see in the Globe this quote from a supermarket industry analyst who said, in the event that the parent company, publicly traded foreign-owned parent company of Hannaford's, does buy Market Basket, he said it's bad news for everybody, bad news for customers and bad news for employees, except it's great news for shareholders. So we'll see what happens there. Well, let's move on to another significant story this week, and that is that of Joseph Donovan. And he was sent to prison in 1992 when he was just 17 years old after he was convicted of the murder of an MIT student. He was tried as an adult at the time. So he spent more than 2 decades of his life in prison. And in the wake of decisions by the Supreme Court and the Supreme Judicial Court, specifically, mandatory life sentences in the state of Massachusetts without parole for juveniles are now considered unconstitutional. So the parole board has granted Joseph Donovan parole. Here he was speaking before the parole board back in May.
I know the choices I've made, I know in the past have been bad and they've caused a lot of pain. And it's my earnest hope that this board can see that I've grown out of the ignorance of my youth into a thoughtful man who's not a danger to society, but hopefully one day will be a benefit to it.
Now, Nancy, we should specify that Joseph Donovan, even though he was convicted of this murder, what he actually did was he punched the victim and someone else stabbed the victim to death. So tell me what your response is to this paroling of Donovan.
Well, the underlying issue here is really a very substantial issue. It's not enough to say that the Supreme Judicial Court declared this unconstitutional. They declared juvenile life without parole unconstitutional because of a finding that really both the science and the social psychology have supported, which is that the juvenile brain is different than the adult brain, that there are impairments with respect to judgment, and in addition, the juvenile brain is capable of changing. So lifelong sentences in which there was no possibility of parole made no sense under the circumstances. So looking at the impairment of judgment. So here you have somebody who punched someone. It's not unusual in the cases that I saw to have the juvenile, typically the younger one, be the driver of the getaway car and have not a real idea about what the other guys are doing.
Well, but in this case, so the actual murderer was even younger.
Yes,
right? He was
right.
15 at the time.
That's right. So you're talking about, you know, one of the things is peer pressure, lack of judgment, et cetera, and the capacity to change. So, I mean, I just chafe at describing this as an abstract, you know, determination that it's unconstitutional. It was unconstitutional because it was wrong. And sadly, the legislature has seen fit now to pass a law requiring 20, 25, or 30 years for juveniles convicted of murder, essentially flying in the face of this teaching.
Well, Joan, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I would just say ditto. What can I say? I don't have that experience that Nancy had, but my gut reaction is that this was a terrible thing, that
right.
somebody would spend that long in jail for throwing a punch that obviously led to a very sad and tragic outcome for somebody. I just wonder, you know, what will it take, how will it be for others who were trying to come before the parole board? And, you know, will they be able to do what Mr. Donovan did?
Right. Well, in fact, this week we also saw another case just like this. Anthony Roland, if I'm saying his name right, he was sentenced for a murder he committed while he was juvenile. And he's also been granted parole. In his case, the family of the victim did not agree with the parole board's decision. But in Joe Donovan's case, the family of the victim said, yes, he should not have been sentenced to life in parole. So, Nancy, how do we balance that equation in terms of the wide variety of responses that victims and their advocates and their families have to this change in perception?
Right. The victims' families are important, but they can't be dispositive. Criminal justice system is not the victim isn't a party in it. It's the public that's a party. And the question is whether the public takes the position, as the courts have taken, that these kids can be changed and do not deserve to be in jail for a long time. Now, the only fly in the ointment here with Donovan, as with the others, is that the parole board, this sounds wonderful abstractly, says we'll release you, but you have to spend one more year in low security and take these programs. Whether or not that's a meaningful release will depend on the availability of programs.
Oh, I see.
So that essentially the state has to step up to make this real.
Well, and one more brief question before we move on to another story. It seems as if the prosecutor at the time when Donovan was first charged and tried, he chose to try him as an adult, even though he was 17, so not quite the age of majority. I don't see any change in the law there, that there's still prosecutorial discretion in Massachusetts whether or not to try juveniles as adults.
There's prosecutorial discretion. And this new statute then says, you know, that there's no judicial discretion. There's a move afoot to change the age of which you're tried as an adult, and that's going across the country from 17 to 18. So discretion would be eliminated if we went to 18.
Mm. Well, let's move on to politics, because there's always something interesting to talk about there, especially in the race for governor, although it might not be exactly what you think. This week, Radio Boston talked with Evan Falchuk. He's an attorney running for governor as an independent, and he's got the goal of securing 3% of the vote, which would give his party official status in the state. Now, he makes claims about both the major parties, Democrats and Republicans in Massachusetts, and he says they're hostages to special interests. But he told us that it's not just Washington that has a problem.
The majority of our legislators are running unopposed. Only 27% of people voted in the last statewide election. We see things happening like not enough funding for programs for education, for veterans, for seniors, for all sorts of very high priorities, but suddenly $1 billion becomes available to build out the convention center in Boston. I don't think that's going to change just by tweaking around the edges at our political processes, but rather by building a new coalition of people.
Now, Joan, this is a call that we've heard before. Do you think it has any chance to resonate with 3% of voters now more than it has in the past?
I think it does. I think he's an interesting candidate. He's got a lot of energy. He appeals to kind of a youth demographic, to an independent kind of voter. And if he's willing to put money behind his effort in advertising, I think he does have a chance of getting the 3%. Mm. Actually, I think on the right, there's Jeff McCormick, who could cause some problems with Charlie Baker, although I think he's much less dynamic than Evan Falchuk.
Yeah, Evan Falchuk is actually a pretty good I was going to say poster boy, but that's not the nicest phrase in the world. But he's a good representative of the possibility of a third party. I mean, Nancy, what do you make of it?
Well, I mean, the third party doesn't necessarily guarantee the kind of politics he's talking about, because you could wind up with third party people running unopposed too. I think the more interesting point he makes is about the vote. And the vote ensures that one point of view, Republican or Democrat, gets both spoken, because it's the people who bother to vote. And that's not all of us. And those are people who can be swayed in the way he describes.
Yeah.
I think a part of his appeal is just the way he answered a question, say, on the convention center. No, we shouldn't spend $1 billion on that. No, we shouldn't have an Olympics. There's no hedging. There's just like a straight answer that I think has an appeal.
Mm, definitely. And I mean, part of that is because he can afford to take the risk, unlike maybe other politicians who have track records that elicit an immediate counter question. But Joan, let me ask you, I mean, part of the reason why maybe someone like Evan Falchuk is getting more attention, and I'll hold my hands up, from we in the media, is because of what I said earlier, that the race between the standard bearers for the Democratic and Republican Party this time around isn't quite as enthralling as maybe voters hope it might be.
Absolutely. I mean, been there, done that, seen that. Coakley v. Baker. So if you have somebody who's got energy, who's interesting, who I don't mind saying is a good poster boy for a third-party effort, why not?
Yeah. Well, let's move on to one last story. This at the State House, and also about the governor, although a different type of gubernatorial story. Outgoing Governor Deval Patrick. Can we call him outgoing yet? He's still got a little ways to go. But he's made a few changes to his office, or the governor's office, in the State House. It's a makeover that includes new drapes, furniture, historically accurate paint, important for that building, and high-tech security, as well as significant structural improvements. It cost $11 million, but it went $2 million over budget. And here's Governor Patrick at the State House answering questions about the renovation.
It is great to have a security system that's secure, and a heating system that heats, and a cooling system that's cool, and it turns out a floor that isn't going to collapse out from under us.
How would you justify going $2 million over budget?
Well, like I said, I think having a floor not collapse underneath us is not a luxury. It turns out to be pretty important.
Now, Joan, you wrote in your column about exactly this issue this week, that on the one hand, while it's important for certain renovations to be done, it also tends to rub taxpayers the wrong way.
And I love when Deval Patrick gets prickly, because questions like that rub him the wrong way. I'm all for the historic preservation, and I think it looks, I didn't go on the tour, but it looks lovely, it looks beautiful, I have no problem with that. I do think it's fair to ask questions when things run over budget, and if it's because of the flooring, that is certainly an acceptable answer, and I have no problem with that. He did get a little bit into the bells and whistles, so I think when you do that, if you're a politician, you have to expect some pushback, and he got the pushback, and he pushed back too, so all's fair in love and politics.
It makes me wonder how, say, Evan Falchuk, if he ever ended up in the governor's office, might deal with a question like that, given that it has to do with spending and maybe not something he necessarily wants to talk about. But Nancy, your thoughts. I mean, some people might say that the media makes too much of a fuss over things like this. But I mean, we are talking about taxpayer-funded renovations.
It is, but I mean, I saw some of the same debates when we were talking about courthouses, and you know, before the Clinton building of new federal courthouses, there were courts in Quonset huts. And now there's a difference between having justice done in one kind of setting versus another kind of setting. Now, that still doesn't address Joan's point about, you know, there are settings that give dignity to the occupant, and then there are settings that go over the top. So I think it's a fair discussion. But if most of this expenditure was because of the structural problems that needed to be addressed, I think he answered the questions. The questions were legitimate. I give you that, Joan. I think he may have answered the question.
Agree.
Well, we've got enough time now today to wrap up with our hubbubs, and those are the stories that fall below the fold or maybe not at the top of the hourly newscast, but are worth a mention anyway. So, Nancy, let's start with you. What's your hubbub?
Well, I like to fashion myself as an amateur astronomer. People don't know this, but when I summer in New Hampshire and I actually can see the sky, I thought it was remarkable. So there was a piece about landing an unmanned device on a comet. And that part of what they're trying to do is to find out the origin of water in the universe. And it is so fundamental and such an extraordinary feat that I thought it deserved more attention.
Absolutely. So sadly, I should say, it's not NASA, it's the European Space Agency.
Right. But the notion, I mean, speaking of a needle in the haystack and getting it so that you could land on it and answering really the fundamental questions about how life began is astonishing to me, and it really was just a couple of line item in the midst of talking about the governor's renovations.
Drapes and floors.
That's right. I mean, it's between drapes and floors. I prefer comets.
It took 10 years for that probe to get there, too. It's an amazing story. Perhaps more amazing, who knew you were an amateur astronomer as well? Joan, your hubbub?
Well, mine has a maternal theme, and for those who want to go to the original source, look on the Globe editorial page today. It's kind of about the role of mothers that have come out in politics and state politics. Steve Grossman's mother is sort of helping him fund a super PAC attack ad, contributing $100,000 to that effort. And Ann Berwick, who's the DPU commissioner, wife of governor candidate Don Berwick, negotiate a solar industry legislation for her son, Ben Berwick. So I don't know if that's like motherly love or extreme helicopter parenting, but these mothers are really getting involved in their sons' ventures right now.
There are so many aphorisms that apply. Like, is politics a family business? Is that an aphorism? Did I make that up? Or behind every...
This is a very close family business.
Yeah, behind every influential man, there's a powerful woman.
Mother. Right. I'm in favor of mothers in control.
All right. Well, my hubbub for today has to do with ICE and fundraising, because as people have noticed this week, a lot of folks in Massachusetts have been getting giant buckets of ice water dumped on their heads. Did you do this, Joan?
No, no, no. I saw it on television.
Joan, were you one of the people who did it?
I didn't. I prefer bubble baths.
Candles, glasses of wine, and bubble bath. I will hold my hands up and say I did not do this either, even though it was for a very good cause, to raise awareness for fundraising around ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease. But the interesting thing about it is that even though many, many people, from politicians, reporters, public figures of all kinds, did film themselves having buckets of ice dumped on their heads, it turns out that this has caused possibly something of an ice shortage at least one company in Massachusetts, the Brookline Ice Company. They've had a huge amount of people coming in to purchase bags of ice for the challenge. They've been delivering to private businesses all over the city, and it's hit them pretty hard, but they're saying that they can keep up with the demands for ice, especially because it's for a good cause. So summertime ice shortage, maybe in an attempt to raise awareness for ALS. That's my hubbub for today. Joan Vernocchi, columnist for the Boston Globe. Always great to talk to you. Thank you so much, Joan.
Nice to be here.
And Nancy Gertner, former federal judge and professor at Harvard Law School. Always great to see you too, Nancy. Thanks.
Nice to see you again.
Well, stick with us, because coming up, we'll talk about how the history of surgery got its major start and major boost here in Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.